Ladies and gentlemen, my name is George Trotter, and this is not a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. One thing we want to state right up front here is that we're plying new ground. This is a format that's completely different than anything you have ever been used to. It is not an AA meeting. It's not an AA fellowship gathering. It is not an AA conference. It's not even one of these more recent here, very popular, high-quality, big book studies. We're asking you to separate and disassociate us from any and all of those things. It has absolutely nothing to do with trying to get you sober. As a matter of fact, if you aren't sober, we're going to ask you to leave. We're not here for Alcoholics Anonymous or a spokesman of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not by AA or for AA. But, and here's where the confusion comes in, it is very muchly about AA. Sitting on my right here is a fella that is 4 months short of being married for 35 years to a very, very gracious lady named Lori. And she's sitting right there in the green shirt with a big grin on her face. They have 4 children, and they have 5 grandchildren. Mel's from Toledo, Ohio. His original hometown is Norfolk, where Johnny Carson, when he was a young man, had the privilege of growing up with Mel. He received his college degree in Toledo, cum laude. B.A. in Communications at the age of 50. He was an editorial writer for the Wall Street Journal. He has 45 articles that were published and have been published in the Grapevine. Certainly makes him one of the top dozen contributors, alongside some pretty brilliant names like Bill Wilson and some of those boys that really wrote a lot in there. Wrote a pamphlet called Pride, another one called Pocket Power. He wrote a pamphlet on the 10th step, a good 10th step. Wrote a pamphlet on the 11th step. Stay up there. Maintaining the New Way of Life. Wrote a pamphlet on slogans of Alcoholics Anonymous. Stay up there. Years, public relations officer, published the newsletter of the Aeroquip Clothes Manufacturing Company, the Flying A. He's written a book, Is There Life After Sobriety? In the United States Navy. He's also a member of the United States LST Association. Landing ship tank, that's what they were. You ever seen any of those old war movies and they got a big mothership and all those little ships go out there and they take everything to shore and all the guys in it? Those were LSTs. Mel served on an LST during World War II. And he's written this book titled LST, Large, Slow Target. It's a complete history of all the LSTs and where they went and who their commanders were and what action and where they were sunk and all of that. His newest book, titled New Wine, Spiritual Roots of Alcoholics Anonymous. Of course, the book you know him best for is second most popular book in Alcoholics Anonymous, published by Alcoholics Anonymous,
after the big book passed it on. And the original title of this was Bill and His Friends, because there was a two-volume set supposed to be done, Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson. And the original fellow who was going to do those, they wanted one volume. They were going to put both of those together. But the guy that got into it and said, hey, there's too much here. We're talking about one separate one on Bob. So he did that. Unfortunately, he passed away before he was able to complete the project. And so the second volume, The Life of Bill Wilson, fell to Mel. Now, he's very, very defensive. I'm going to have to point out here, if I don't want to get both of my legs cut out from underneath me tonight, that he is not the author. He's not the sole author. There's four people working on that thing. I did the manuscripts, turned them in, and I said, well, Mel, how much did you? He said, well, they kept the first 12 or 13 chapters pretty much be the way I wrote it. He said, well, there aren't that many chapters in here. So we will be major contributing author, shall we say. He's presently working on a book right now on Eddie, the gentleman who brought the message to Bill. His date of sobriety is April 15th, 1950. And if you're counting up there, that means he's 36 days away from being continuously sober for 45 years. The big book on page 93, it says the main thing is that he was willing to believe in a power greater than himself and to live by spiritual principles. I don't know of anybody that exemplifies that anymore. And the guy that's sitting on mine right here, he's, in my personal opinion, the world's definitive expert on Bill Wilson. He's only spent 45 years studying that gentleman. And if anybody can bring him to life, he's what I privilege to call myself a friend, Mel Barker.
Well, thank you, George. I think I'll take you everywhere. Well, I would like to introduce George Trotter. And I met George last February, a little over a year ago. We were over here in Harvey. I can't remember what that conference was called, but the regional conference.
We are not
saints. Now, we are not saints, I guess that was, but it was a sort of a regional conference, and it was really one of those things where you meet people, and I can't even remember how we happened to go to that conference. I guess we met somebody from that area that somehow we were invited. Pardon? Well, I don't know why we were invited, though. I'm a great believer in synchronicity. I don't know whether many of you have seen that term popping up lately, but it's just amazing if you look at your own life and the things that happen, and you think, well, I married this person, or I had this job, and I worked here 20 years, and how'd you happen to get the job? And, well, I walked in the drugstore and met this fellow. The only reason you got that job is because you walked in the drugstore, see? What if you'd gone on down the street to another drugstore? You ask yourself those things. I knew a fellow in AA who had been out of work for months. He was a newspaper man. And he took a different subway one day, and there was an old friend on the subway, asked him if he was still out of work. I said, yeah. And he had some job that was right at his fingertips, but they never said, were ready to say quite yes, you know. And so this fellow said, well, hey, there's a job up at the National Council of Alcoholism. They need a communications director. And he went up there and worked there the next 10 or 12 years and was really happy in the job. And the only reason he got the job is because he took a different subway that day. But he didn't know that this fellow would be on the subway and that kind of thing. But my point is that works that way in everybody's life, not just a few people now and then, but everybody, your own life. You start looking at all the things that have happened to you, how you got into AA and how you knew different people, and there's something that was coordinating things, and you and I weren't doing it because we don't even know that these things are going to happen. So I'm here in Valparaiso tonight because I met George last February, and then I met George because I met somebody else at some time, and it just goes on and on. And my wife, by the way, went to Valparaiso University here for 2 years, and I'm not going to say when that was, in the 1950s. But this is all cornfields out here then, I think, when she did remember a turkey place down there where they always had turkey sandwiches, and she asked the woman at the Walmart today if that was still a turkey place, and it was. Now, her going to that turkey place, was that why she wound up with a turkey? I don't know. Well, anyway, I want to talk about George. I'm not going to talk about myself here. But anyway, I met George, and he started calling me up and asking me all kinds of questions about AA history. He always introduces himself as the AA police. And we stopped to see George at his home a week or two ago when we were coming back from the South. And he is an amazingly well-organized guy, and he has the best AA archives I've ever seen. Probably of all the materials that he's collected are just as thorough as what they have in New York at the archives. And it's amazing. I think George has been in AA now about 9 years or 10 years. Isn't that right? I didn't have your sobriety date down here. Pardon?
7 years.
And you've accumulated...
Seven.
Yeah, right. You've accumulated all of this material. Now, I'm the sort of a guy that I have a hard time organizing papers and facts and all that kind of thing. When I start writing something, I wind up... Well, actually, if the fire inspector were to come around, I'd get closed down because there's just papers all around. But George is not that way. He is completely organized. And he can take something and really put it together and catalog it and pin it down. I had a bunch of tapes. I'd made about 117 tapes when I was working on Pass It On. I interviewed people all over the country. And these are valuable tapes because many of these people have gone on. And some of them were involved with the pioneers of AA, you know. And they sat there in those boxes for years, and I looked at them every day and thought, by God, someday I got to do something with those tapes. And I looked at them for years, you know, 15 years. That was back in 80 and 81 when I did those. Well, then George came to Toledo about 6 weeks or 2 months ago, and they're all perfectly copied and organized and cataloged, and everything's all set. We've got a set made for the archives in New York and everything else. And there it is, preserved for posterity, all because of George. And so people like this, they might be odd, but they're useful. And George,
thank you, Mel.
Well, no, I was just amazed. And we didn't get a chance to meet Mrs. Trotter. I called her the long-suffering Mrs. Trotter. But she is an art teacher and makes dolls and things like that. And we happened to see her workroom, and it's like my workroom. She's completely disorganized. So this is a case of two people, George and his wife. They're like the two guys in The Odd Couple. For one of them is Felix, and what was the other one's name? You know,
Oscar. It's
Oscar and Felix. And I don't know which one was Oscar and which one was Felix. But George is the one that's really well organized that way. And George is a native of Jacksonville, Illinois, which is down near Springfield. And he was born there and grew up there and lives in the same house he grew up in. And he was a history teacher and a graduate. Now, I had this written down where you graduated. And you, George, went to college at the regular time and graduated when you should have, instead of waiting until you're 50, you know. I got my college degree when I was 50. He went to McKendree College. Isn't that right?
You're amazing.
Well, it just floated into my mind.
I'm supposed to be the AA police here.
Yeah. And I got my college degree at age 50, and I always say that a 50-year-old college graduate is like a 35-year-old virgin. At that age, nobody gives a damn anymore. George taught history in high schools, and right now he's between jobs, which gives him time to work on this AA material. And I feel that George has a niche somewhere in life of doing all this stuff for AA, because there's a lot of, it's amazing how many people out there are interested in the history of AA, and even at any group, if you start talking about it, some of the members won't be, but there will always be two or three people that are very curious and want to know more, and I've run into those people. There are people in Akron and places like that that just are insatiable in their desire to learn more about AA. And Bill Wilson, I met Bill Wilson, I didn't really meet him in 1951. I heard him speak in February of night, real cold night in February. I was living in Pontiac, Michigan, and the story of that is in, I think it's on page 348 or something, in Pass It On, of hearing Bill Wilson. And Bill was very careful about keeping records of everything. He kept all his copies of all his letters and everything. But he wanted the history of AA to be presented truthfully and without distortion. Now, Bill himself made a few mistakes and dates and things like that, but I think Bill was very honest in his desire to have the history of AA recorded very faithfully. I heard Bill speak, that was in when he was promoting what was called the Third Legacy, when they formed the General Service Conference. Now, Dr. Bob had died. He died in November of 1950. So just after that, Bill took off and toured the major cities and spoke, promoting this idea of a Third Legacy, a General Service Conference, and that's what kicked it off. And, the three things, recovery, unity, and service. And that service was the Third Legacy. And he came to Detroit and he talked for 2 hours at Cass Technical High School. And large crowd then. I imagine there were 1,000 or more there to hear him even then. Even then, in 1951, there were a lot of AA members in a place like Detroit. Now, of course, many times more than that. But even then, we thought AA was very large. And then I didn't meet Bill again, or hear him again, until 1956 in Akron at Founders Day. And I went up to Bill and wanted to talk to him. And I told him I was from Jackson, Michigan. And Bill just said, well, my knowledge of Jackson goes back to Al Cameron's time. Al Cameron was the founder of AA in Jackson. And this is his book here. One of these. This one. I believe it's this one here. It's got Al Cameron's name. Of course, he's been long gone. But just like that, Bill remembered his name and everything. He had that kind of a memory, especially for the founders of AA. But he was too tired that night to talk to me, so he had asked me to write him a letter. And I did. And I got back a very long letter where he talked about his problems, his depression, and everything else. And I still have that letter, and some of the things in that letter wound up and Pass It On. Then I think the next time I heard Bill was in 1958, at Founders Day. And I think Bill was going out to Founders Day in the 1950s because there was a lot of conflict between Bill and some of the Akron people then. And I think he was kind of mending fences by going out there for Founders Day. But he was very well received then. I mean, when he would come up, walk onto the stage there in the field house at Akron University, everybody would give him a standing ovation when he came in, as they always did. And I took some pictures of Bill at that time. We've got him, got the picture somewhere.
Well, we're there. The poor folks at home, I'm sitting here looking at this fellow taping this, and Mel's pointing to a book, and we've got two first printings of the first edition here sitting in front of us. when it came out in 1939, if you got the very first one, it looked like that. You can see why they called it the Big Book. Actually, they didn't call it the Big Book when it first came out. It wasn't until by the sixth printing it got a little smaller. By the seventh printing, it got a lot smaller. By the eighth printing, it was almost the size of our 12 and 12 today. They got to looking at that, and they said, oops, this was the Big Book, you know. We have a pair of those up here. Tex, a lot of you know Tex from Chicago here. Anybody got more than 47 years? I know a lot of you folks out there. I love to do this because my very good friend is sitting here in the front row, Gene, and he's got 37 years.
No, 36. The last 2 days I have a 37.
I stand correct. And our home group is, we belong to a Big Book study group. We're very cautious. You don't get your coin until it's your time, you know. But Tex, you're 47 years, is that? 48. So I've been kidding Gene all the way up here because, you know, down around home, they have these sobriety countdowns and stuff, and he's always the last one to stand, and, you know, and he gets kind of used to being the last one there.
You ain't telling them what I told you I was going to do.
Tell them, Gene.
I told them I had my suitcase full of this whiskey. I was going to get them all drunk, and none of them could say they had it more time than I did.
We're talking sobriety in the room here tonight, you know. It's always a pleasure to be around these gentlemen. Anyway, back to the Big Book. That was I was going to say something about it, and I kind of forgot it now. We have a very visual display as we go through these things. And we're going to be pointing out things and showing things, and it's just not going to come out on the tape there. We apologize for that. We don't know what else to do about it. This isn't a speaker's meeting or anything like that. It's we just decided that we were going to fly by the seat of our pants. That we're just going to sit and talk and converse and... oh, my God. Didn't even see you come in. We've been waiting for guys to fly in from New York City today.
Good to be here.
You said you were going to come in about 7 a.m. What happened?
A little bit farther than you said it was.
You didn't ask. Oh, my God. Well, and you lose track. And we're not experts. I want to point that out. I think we both have a great deal of expertise in the area. I love Ernie Kurtz's remark. He said he's the fellow that wrote this book, The Definitive History of Alcoholics Anonymous, not God. He wrote that, as a matter of fact, to get his PhD. He has a doctorate, and this is his doctoral thesis. I've, you know, cleaned up a little bit so the $10 words got down to be like $6 words, you know. And it still is The Definitive History of Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, I've got a whole set here of the basic history reference material. A lot of folks ask us, where do you find out this stuff? And so I bring this along, and you can look through there and see and find out where to get them and stuff. 79, he wrote this in 79, and we had lunch, what, a month or so ago, and he made this comment. He's really amazed that this is an historical work. It is supposed to be questioned and to look at and to find out where the holes are in it. It has stood for so... Nobody has seriously questioned anything in it. And Ernie is totally amazed. He said, you know, either somebody out there, nobody cares, maybe. You know, it can't be that good. His remark that I do this a lot. You're going to notice this over the weekend. I'll start here and I go around a very big circle and then we wind up where I was supposed to go to begin with. His remark was that there are no experts in AA on AA. Good Lord, he got his PhD in alcoholics. He's not an expert, you know. If you use the term the leading expert, the best expert, the only expert. Now, I have a lot of trouble. But, yeah, there are experts. Know everything all the time? No. I read a definition expert that said, a person who is so knowledgeable about the subject that his opinions become facts. And I look at Mel here, and good Lord, ever since I've been coming to AA, people have been quoting stuff out of passage. I mean, that's factual. As you're going, and here's the man that his opinions became those facts. That's certainly a good definition for expert. But if you talk to Mel, see, he's going to say, no way, not me. What we're presenting here are our opinions based upon the facts. They happen to match the facts. If those facts change, then maybe our opinions will change too. We're giving you the best of what we got that we know now. We might be wrong. If we are and we make mistakes and we got some stuff wrong, we apologize. And I love Dr. Bob has a son, Smitty, and he's married to a very, very wonderful lady, Betty. And Betty says, I hope that you can blow away my imperfections with the breath of your forgiveness. God, what a wonderful lady. I hope you can do that for us, too. I do this because these people that we're going to be talking about saved my life. I can't think of any other better form of appreciation than to know as much as I possibly can about them. In all of their wonderful human imperfections, all of the fun things they did, all of the serious things they did. The better I get to know them, the deeper my appreciation of the gift that I have received from them is. The better I can understand myself and allow myself to be a human being. Because there are just, this is the most phenomenal story. That's all history is, his story. The most phenomenal, wonderful story. It's heartwarming, it's crushing, it's hilarious, it's deadly. No fiction writer could ever sit down and come up with this. And the deeper I get into it, the better I appreciate what I've got. I love these people. I've fallen in love with a book, the big book. I've fallen in love with the people who wrote it, and I have a burning desire to know more. And so I'm going to share with you this weekend some of the things that I know, and then Mel can correct me.
There you go.
Well, before you interrupted me, George, I was telling about hearing Bill in Akron in 1958, and that was the third time that I'd heard Bill talk, and this was the second time I'd met him. I talked very briefly with him in 56, and then I guess in 57 I didn't make it there, and then in 1958, and at that time the Founders Day in Akron was just one day. It was maybe Saturday night. It's become a big weekend now. And thousands of people come there. It's just amazing. It's getting to be the biggest AA gathering anywhere. They take buses. They go by Dr. Bob. Well, Dr. Bob's house is now a museum. And it's in a kind of a downtown neighborhood that's close to the downtown now. And they've got a monument in the front yard. And this is where AA was founded and so on. And there are hundreds of people milling around that house. I've often wondered what the neighbors must think, you know, on Founders Day. And they're selling T-shirts and coffee mugs. I had a drink at Dr. Bob's, you know. And then Founders Day was only about a day, and maybe 1,000 people would come or something, if that many. I said 1,000. And in the notice of the Founders Day, it said they were going to have a service at Dr. Bob's grave. And I thought, I'd never really known Dr. Bob. I'd called him up once on one of my last drunks, but I'd never known him. And incidentally, I did that in January of 1950, and when he died in November, I really felt guilty. I never told anybody about that for 2 or 3 years, you know, that I'd called that man. I always had telephonitis when I drank, and then when I got an AA and started having slips, I called up AAs, you know, prominent AAs. Not the President of the United States, people I thought were prominent in AA. But anyway, they were having this graveside service on Sunday morning at Dr. Bob's grave. And I thought, well, we wouldn't be, it was probably just for friends and people like that. So this friend of mine and I, we drove down there, and he didn't want to stay in the Mayflower Hotel because it was too expensive. So we stayed at a flea bag down the street. And we got up the next morning, and this flea bag didn't have a coffee shop. And here again is this synchronicity working. And so we went down the street a couple blocks to the Mayflower. And of course, you know, that's where Bill Wilson was staying when he called Henrietta Seiberling and all that. And now it's not even operating as a hotel. But we went into the coffee shop of the Mayflower, and we sat down at a table. And we were having coffee, waiting for our breakfast. And Bill walks in. And the coffee shop had a counter, and he sat down at the counter. And this friend says, I said, well, there's Bill. And the friend says, well, let's invite him over to the table. And I said, no, I already knew by then about Bill's depressions and everything. And I thought, well, maybe he wanted to be alone, didn't want to be bothered with any AA members. And so I just said, hi, Bill, like that. And he waved back. And then as soon as he got his coffee, he picked it up and came over and sat down with us. And so then we heard Bill's for about an hour. Other people came along, and then we heard Bill talking. You know, he started telling about his idea about AA and how AA had come of age in 1955 out in St. Louis and been turned over to the membership. And he kind of likened himself to a parent, like a dad, that if the kid is only 16 and he gets the cook in trouble, but then the dad has some responsibility, you know, to help the kid out. He got the cook in trouble. But if the kid is 21 and he gets the cook in trouble, well, then he's on his own. And that's kind of the way Bill felt about AA. And I often wondered, what was there in Bill's background that made him think about getting the cook in trouble, you know? Because I had remembered a few wealthy families that had cooks, and I couldn't ever remember any of them I would have wanted to get in trouble. But Bill must have had something in his experience where that happened. But anyway, that was an example he would use. Well, then we sat there, and Bill ate breakfast. We finished our breakfast. And I always remember Bill picked up the bacon and ate it, and I wondered, I didn't think that was the way people should do, but I guess that's the way it was. And then a guy came along to pick Bill up to take him out to this service. And I said, is it all right if we go along? And sure enough, so we had about a dozen cars, and we went out to the Mount Peace Cemetery in Akron and for this service. And as I was getting out of my car, I remembered I had the camera in the trunk. And I've edited this company magazine and did stories out in the field and things like that, and I had this Rolleiflex. And so I asked Bill if it was all right if I took pictures. And so I wound up taking 2 or 3 rolls of pictures, and I'm really grateful that I did that. And I have one of the pictures here today. There were about 3 dozen people maybe in that group. And it was a bright June Sunday morning. It was Father's Day, June 15th, 1958. And I heard somebody whisper that Dr. Bob's daughter couldn't be there. She had wanted to be there, but her husband was drunk that weekend. She had married one of the people whose story was in the big book, but he never did really get sober, and he was drunk and causing a lot of trouble, and I thought that was one of the saddest things, that she couldn't be there at that service for her parents. And Bill went over to the gravestone, and he started talking to Dr. Bob and Ann, just like they were actually there, and I wrote a little story about that. And then just as we stopped and, you know, to say the Lord's Prayer, I guess, or something, why, a bell started ringing, a church bell. And a woman next to me, she just gasped at that timing, you know, that perfect timing. It was just a beautiful June morning. And that was the third time that I had seen Bill and the second time I'd met him. And then going down to New York on trips a couple times, I saw Bill. I talked to him once. I never talked to him for more than 15 or 20 minutes where I had him all to myself to talk to. And then in 1963, I went down to New York to work for the Wall Street Journal. And I went down there to make my million, and I made it so fast that I was only there less than a year. But at that time, I was on the Grapevine editorial board. They invited me to be on. And so every month, we'd have these meetings in the evening, a monthly meeting, and Bill would come to these meetings. And it was just, you know, like you got used to being around him. And I saw him several times and the last time I saw him in 1964, it was in the John at General Service Headquarters. And we talked a little bit, and then he went in the stall, and I could tell from the sounds emitting from that stall that Bill was a human being. Yeah, that was the last time I ever saw Bill. I wasn't going to say things like this.
Now that you got your $10 worth, we're going home. We're going to set up around different things. On the table here behind you, we're going to rotate some different displays. What you see there now on the resin, the claws, the table claws, right? We try and keep this in the, where's the dust jacket? Give me a 1-1 dust jacket. Or hold it up back there if you would, Bruce. This is the, one of the stories that appeared in the first edition of the big book was an artist's concept. The fellow that wrote that was an artist, commercial artist, and this is the dust jacket that he designed for the book. It's sometimes called the circus dust jacket because of the red, white, black, and yellow. And they made up... Oh, yeah, show that. An original manuscript, yes. As secretary, poor Ruth Hawk. And Bill would dictate over her shoulder, and she'd peck away, and he'd escape every chance he had to get out of there because he just really didn't like doing that kind of stuff. She typed out that manuscript, and then they printed up on what you'd call today, it was called a lithograph, a multilith, you cranked that up, mimeograph machine. They printed up 400 of those. And they sent them out to AAs all over the country. They sent them to psychologists. They sent them to doctors, ministers, anybody that might have some kind of an input into this thing. And, you know, put your comments on it and send it back to us. And they cleaned up what they wanted and got her fixed up. They took her down to the printer, and then they printed 5,000 copies of the book titled Alcoholics Anonymous. They didn't sell very well. They didn't sell worth a tooth. Beginning, but eventually picked up as time went on, and sold out. So they came up with a second printing. Another 5,000 of those, picked up a little more, sold printing. A third printing of it, fourth print, fifth print, and all totals. Hold up one of those later ones down there towards the end, there, Bruce. Hold up an 11th or 12th or something there at the end. They're all about the same. Yeah, take the dust jacket off of that one. You can see what they did. The folks raised Cain about this red book. Said, you know, we're into humility and being secret and stuff, everything. That red's like too flashy. So
Bill said, okay, you can take the dust jacket off if you want to. They took the gold lettering off of it, and from there on out, then it's been blue. So then they got down, they printed some more, printed some more, printed some more. They did that 16 times, and what you see over there on the table is one each of each one of those 16 printings. And you can take a look at the sign there says, please don't handle, but you know, I know how it is. I remember when I saw my first one. You know, sometimes you just got to touch them, you know. But go ahead, feel free. Then after they got up to 1955, that 16th printing came out, 1955, they were always concerned from the very, very beginning that there wasn't a pretty good mix here. These people, if you look and get in, and we're going to show you some of them. We got pictures of them and stuff here, and we'll talk about some of their stories. They're just D-less stories. You look at them overall, though, they are middle to late age, white, Protestant, male, upper class kind of folks, you know. And Bill was always worried, always concerned. He said, you know, can't we reach anybody else? Is this going to be narrowed in? Is alcoholism going to be defined this way to only these people? I mean, you know, there are people out there dying all over. If it is a disease and can affect anybody, if it's an equal opportunity destroyer, what are we doing with this very narrow set of folks here, you know? So by the time 1955 rolled around and that 16th printing had happened, AA had now grown enough, and we got women, and we got Native Americans, and we got blacks, and we got young folks, and so they mixed up. They did not change the first 164 pages. It says on the front there, it says, this is the text of Alcoholics Anonymous, the text book. It isn't a novel, it isn't fiction, it is a text to instruct you on something. They didn't change the text. The instructions, the first 164 pages. But what they did was they went in the back and said, now we got all kinds of folks, so let's mix up. A lot of folks think that if your story was taken out of the big book, that meant that you went out and got drunk and they were ashamed of you. They pulled your story, you know. Yes, that occurred. But that wasn't the purpose of the new edition. And later on we're going to have another edition. That wasn't the purpose of this next third edition either. The purpose was to mix it up a lot more and show that it could affect us, to widen the perspective. Hey, while we're in there, you know, let's take some out. But if, for instance, you were one of these middle-class white Protestant folks in there, and they were looking for a young woman, they pull your story, you know. You got beat out because she was better looking and younger than you were. That's all there was to it. It didn't necessarily mean you were drunk, but it was a good opportunity to pull the folks who they knew were drinking again. And fix up some grammar and a little stuff like that, you know. So they did that, and they came out with this. You might want to show them there, the second edition now, 1955. Bill was a salesman. Let's not forget this is also, besides being Alcoholics Anonymous, it's a book business. That just amazingly enough came out in just in time for the 1955 International Alcoholics Anonymous in St. Louis, Missouri. And if you listen to some of the tapes that they made of the International, and this is your last, you hear the guy get up the mic, this is your last chance, and the new books are out in the library, right in the lobby, you just go out and here, look at this one, and make sure you get your new one before you go home and everything, you know. The white band you see around that is a highly unusual item. That band was placed on there for the books that were sold at the International as their opening publicity of it. You're not going to see that on any later books. Mm-hmm. Introducing the new revised edition. And so they printed it, and they sold those out, and the next one they sold it out, and then the next third printing sold it out, fourth printing. They went through 16 printings of that second edition, and then by 1976 they said, hey, you know, let's change the stories in the back of the book again. By that time, you got 10 of anybody you wanted. I don't care what kind of a person, we got them out there. You want a communist? who's a well digger and, you know, under 6 foot three, wears only green shirts and smokes on Thursdays. We got one. So they kept the text up there, and that is our present. If you buy one from GSO today, that's the one you're going to get the third printing. And we're on the 54th printing of it right now. 54 printings of it. It's got to be in the top. It's got to be in the top. Everybody thinks about Gone with the Wind, you know. That's the biggest
last
seller.
Last time I heard it was Second to the Bible.
Second to the Bible. I've heard that. I have no reason to doubt that. I know Gone with the Wind sold a lot of books, but I mean, who's buying Gone with the Wind these days, right? They're buying those just as fast as you can print them out, you know. I wouldn't have. The continuously published same time. I'd have no problem with that. It's got to be. It's also got to be 745. How are we doing on the takedown?
It's just about out.
So we're going to change that display over there. And when you come in, like tomorrow morning, we're going to have something out there for you. But feel free to look over there on that end and have at it. And then we're going to float some other displays through here. And Mel and I are just going to look at something. And if we get an idea, and we're going to feed off of it, we're going to go. And give you a 15-minute break. We'll come back here and actually start into getting into some of the stuff. What do you think we ought to add here?
Well, I think we're okay for this session.
Okay, do you get in free if you have matching sweaters?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mel's on synchronicity, right?
What color are you guys wearing?
Well, we'll see you in 15 minutes then.
Hi, my name's George Trotter. We're back again. It's 9 o'clock in the morning. We're going to rock and roll.
Hi, George. Good morning, George.
George. Can you folks way back? Can you hear me back there in the back? Is that all right? Yeah, all right. Well, it just send up a runner if you can't quite hear us. We're scared to death of all them people down there in the auditorium on that big screen TV. You know, we don't want to get too... we want to let you all know that we've been getting some pretty last night. I talked around. We're getting some good feedback on this, the open format kind of thing, flying by the seat of our pants. We've never had any bad luck with this. It's just a great deal. Of course, this is the first time we're doing it, so that may have something. If you got any questions, just bring them on out. We'll stop. We'll try and answer them. We want to make it we don't want to turn it into a canned speech or anything like that. We do want you to pay attention, though, because this is the last time that this is ever going to happen. Because the next time, you see, it's going to be completely different. We don't want to get into a canned kind of a deal. What do you want to say this morning? Get us going, Mel. Wake us up a little bit.
Well, why don't we start with a moment of silence and the serenity.
Sounds good.
God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Well, I'm Al Barger. I'm an alcoholic.
No, I'm Al.
And we were going to start this morning on the Oxford group. And right from the beginning, when I first got an AA, even before I got sober, it took me 18 months, really, to get continuous sobriety established, but I was interested in the background of AA and in the Oxford group. For example, that old article by Jack Alexander that was published in the Saturday Evening Post in 1941, that was a major turning point for AA, that article. And it mentioned the Oxford group in there. And I found out many years later when I was working on Pass It On that Bill W. didn't want the Oxford group even mentioned in that article. By that time, their feelings about the Oxford group had changed so much that he thought it was a real negative. And when Jack Alexander sent the article to him for approval, Alexander said something like, "I know you don't want us to mention the Oxford group, but I felt that I should," or something like that. In other words, as a journalist, Alexander felt that he had a duty to do that, but Bill Wilson would have preferred that he didn't. So he... Obviously, Bill had expressed some feelings to Alexander, hoping that the Oxford group wouldn't be mentioned. That was in 1941, by the way. But anyway, we owe a lot
to the Oxford Group. In fact, we owe about 95% of the program, I would say, to this fellowship called the Oxford Group. And it has an amazing history. It was founded by a fellow named Frank Bootman. And all of the time that, after I discovered this, for years, I looked for some mention of AA in connection with, by the time I got an AA, the Oxford Group had been renamed Moral Rearmament. And we saw big advertisements in the newspapers for Moral Rearmament. They were still strong in the 1950s, or fairly strong. And they would run big ads offering the Four Absolutes as an ideology. And every now and then I would read about Bookman, because I was living in Michigan, and every summer the Oxford Group had their big rallies on Mackinac Island in northern Michigan. And these got a lot of press at that time. So I always wondered why there was no mention of AA, and also why in AA there was never any mention of Frank Bookman. And I even wondered in those years if Bookman knew that AA had come out of the Oxford Group, because there just seemed to be complete silence on it. Well, in 1961, I believe, or right around then, I was in New York, and I was talking to Bill briefly again, these brief encounters that I had with him, and I asked him if he knew Bookman. And he said only to shake hands, apparently at some big meeting back in the early times. He had stood in line with people, and he had shaken hands with Bookman, that kind of thing. And then I asked him about the separation from the Oxford Group, and this was a fleeting question. And he said that they had separated in New York in 37. We know that. That's in the history. But in Akron, they stayed until 1939 because there was this wonderful couple out there that was in the Oxford Group, and that, of course, was T. Henry and Clarice Williams, and that's all in the AA writings, too, about these people. And then I said, asked Bill what the real reason was for separating from the Oxford Group, and the only answer I got, something else came up. He had to go somewhere or something, and that was the end of the conversation. But he said, well, for one thing, he got in trouble with the Catholic Church, and he says, that would have kept a lot of Irishmen from getting sober. Something like that. This was Bill's way of talking. Maybe it was word for word what I'm saying here, but that was the way he would express things. And but there were other things, other reasons, of course, and we know about them. But he obviously, Bill himself, didn't really think too much of Bookman, Lois Holt. But yet, if we look back at it, we realize that without Bookman, there wouldn't have been any Oxford Group. And around 1978, I was put in touch with a fellow named Willard Hunter. Not an alcoholic, but an old Oxford grouper. And this Willard Hunter is a fine guy. He lives out where does he live? Oh, in Claremont, California. But he's all over all the time, so sometimes you forget where he lives. But today he's about 80 years old and still vigorous and in excellent health and everything. And he had been a Bookman protege for about 18 years. He had left Harvard Law School to follow Bookman back in 1938. And he had been very dedicated to the Oxford Group principles. And nowadays, he seems to work a lot trying to give the Oxford Group and Bookman more credit for what has happened in AA. For example, if he reads something about an AA in an encyclopedia, he'll write to the editor and tell him the facts and suggest that maybe in their next edition they should update it, that kind of thing. So I think that the additional knowledge that I acquired about the Oxford Group, I kind of dabbled in it up until 1978, but that was largely due to Willard Hunter and the things he told me and so on. And it was really through Willard Hunter that I learned how the Oxford Group had worked in Akron before Bill Wilson ever came out there in 1935. And, of course, I have to say that's all in my book here. George, I'm talking at length here. Why don't you go ahead and take over? And I've just been rambling about the Oxford Group.
Well, I'll ramble a little bit, too.
Yes. That's
as good.
But we want to go into the background of how Bookman had his spiritual experience and started the Oxford Group and so on, but Why don't you just take
Maybe go back a little bit further than that. Bill Wilson all made the comment. He said, this is not new stuff. It's all come from ancient principles, and I didn't invent anything, maybe kind of reworded it or whatever. Matter of fact, they asked Dr. Bob one time, they said, well, now, where did this big book, where did this come from? And Bob said, well, it really only came from three sources. The Bible. The best I can do is to start with a fella called Dwight L. Moody, great evangelist. There's still the Moody Bible Company still today in Chicago's publishing stuff. Moody was the real, I can't get any direct hits back before Moody, but I haven't done a lot in that area, so we may be able to take it back even further. Here's one of Moody's. To the work. Personal evangelism. Go out there and get them. Bring Christ into the lives. Make him vital into people's lives. 12 select sermons. Moody had a lot of sermons. This is just his select sermons. Here's The Great Redemption. Sermons, addresses, Bible readings, and prayers of D.L. Moody. Moody is going to run across and have influence on the next in the row here. Henry Drummond is his name. And they were sitting around somewhere at an evangelist meeting or a tent camp somewhere. After it was over, they were sitting around the fire, a bunch of them. And Moody said, you know, I've been just talking to my friend here, Henry Drummond, and he has come up with something that's absolutely brilliant. He's boiled this all down to unconditional love. Why don't you talk about it? And Moody gave it over to Henry Drummond, and he just took off. He boiled it all down to the greatest thing in the world. He wrote a book there. They finally encouraged him to put it into a book. The Greatest Thing in the World by Henry Drummond. And Moody just loved him. He gave this all basically directly to Drummond, and Drummond was able to put it together in very simplistic terms. The idea on that, we've got The Greatest Thing in the World over there. So I think I got a first printing of it. Yeah. Very first printing of this ever. The message of the Old Testament was giving basic laws and explaining them. The message of Jesus in the New Testament was, he says, I am not here to change any of those laws. By the time the New Testament came around, the Jews had taken these laws from the Old Testament and turned them into hundreds of thousands of different things and little rituals, and he had to do it. And a good Orthodox Jew of that time would have to get out of bed and start all of the little rituals and things from the very time, and go all day long and still not. They made it so complicated. They had, you know, we talk about Rule 62. It really got out of hand. Jesus came in the New Testament and says, hey, I want to make this simple. Unconditional love. And it was brought over and over several times. I'd say, love your neighbor. Do unto others as you have others do unto you. Forgive my trespasses, I forgive. Unconditional love. Drummond just bored right in on that. You will automatically, Jesus said, I'm not here to change any of these laws, I'm to simplify them. If you practice unconditional love, you will automatically fulfill all 12. Or all 10, I mean, of the commandments. Yeah, there's not 12. It's real early in the morning. Boo.
Let me take over on Drummond there and this sort of thing. Now, when I was going into the history of this thing, the last thing I wanted to find was giving any credit to a guy like Dwight L. Moody, because I'd been approached a couple times in Chicago by people from the Moody Bible Institute, and I wanted to distance myself from them as much as possible, you know. These were people that come up and hand you a tract and that kind of thing. But over the years, I've changed my views a lot on that, and I'm a lot more sympathetic to this than I was in the past. I have a lot more feeling for it. But one of the little booklets that I found when I first came in AA was The Greatest Thing in the World. In fact, there was a recommended reading list that I found out in Ventura, California, where I went to my first meetings. And the first thing on the list was the Bible. The second thing was the Big Book. And then they had, like, the Sermon on the Mount by Emmett Fox, As a Man Thinketh by Allen. But this one was in there, the greatest thing in the world. And this this little book has amazingly stayed in print ever since it was first published. Well, Dwight L. Moody, he was an evangelist, of course. He was the Billy Graham of his day, you might say, and very popular. And in 1872, he went over to England and Scotland and conducted some revivals. And that's where he met Henry Drummond. And Henry Drummond was a professor at the University of Edinburgh, I believe, and a very well-educated man with a scientific mind. And Drummond tried to make religion and science compatible. He did some writings along that line. But in the summers, Moody had what they called the Northfield Conferences up in Northfield, Massachusetts, his hometown. He started a college up there, and they used the dorms up there for students to come in the summer, and they had these religious conferences. And these were very important to the future of religion in the United States. Some of the greatest people in American religion attended these conferences back in the 1880s and 1890s. They were called the Northfield Conferences. And in 1887, Drummond was there, and he gave this talk to the students. And then Moody was so impressed with it that he had his brother-in-law, a fellow named Fleming Revell, whose name is still applied to a publishing company, had him publish it. And this has been in print ever since. It was one of Dr. Bob's favorite little books, and it's had a great influence in AA, and it was used in the Oxford Group, of course, and all of that. And Frank Buchman, the guy who eventually started the Oxford Group, was very much influenced by Moody, as were all of the leading people of that time in religion. But this takes 1 Corinthians 13, the great chapter on love, and just breaks it down piece by piece and discusses it. And now Henry Drummond, wrote a lot of things, but nothing else ever stayed in print except this. And incidentally, by... Yes, Steve?
Was that book based on his speech to the students?
It was the speech.
This was the speech.
Yeah, this was what he gave. You could even tell by the way it's worded that he's talking to the students. He's telling about some of you will be missionaries, and you go out, and you find that other people, even in the religious field, are jealous of you, or things like this, showing how even people that are spiritually inclined have all these ugly motives at times. About the elder brother that does everything he's supposed to, but he hates the prodigal, you know, that comes back and all of this. And fortunately, in AA, we don't have any of these jealousies or stuff like that. We've risen above all of that. But Drummond, even by that time, now here's an interesting thing. I read somewhere else that even by that time, some of Dwight L. Moody's associates didn't want him to invite Drummond anymore. They disapproved of Drummond because of his intellectualism and his attempts to prove scientific facts or show that they were justified and everything. And they didn't like the fact that he smoked cigars, too. Well, I don't think I would like that too much either. It's all I can do to put up with George's cigarettes. But you see, even there, there was a dissension and friction. We sometimes feel bad about all the friction we have at AA, but gosh, everybody has it. It just comes along. But that's almost like a God-given book. You see, we get back to that synchronicity, and he gives this in the summer in 1887, and here we are almost 110 years later, and there are people still reading that book and changing their lives. I gave it to a guy one time that was in our company, and he wasn't getting along with anybody. And that book kind of changed his life a little bit. In fact, before long, he was making more money than I was. Go ahead.
Title of that book again,
The Greatest Thing in the World by Henry Drummond.
That title just made me think of Ognandino.
Oh, yes. Sure.
To that in his book.
Oh, sure. That's right. In fact, I think Og Mandino used that title for a book.
Knock off?
Yeah.
The greatest salesman in the world, the greatest.
Oh, yeah. That idea. This, you know, you can't copyright titles. Yeah.
Who's Og Mandino?
Very close.
Well, he's a best-selling writer, and he uses. Have you got an Og Mandino book?
I don't think so.
Now, if you got those books by Jesse Penn Lewis.
Yes.
If I could have those, I'd like to have
Let's go maybe from move on here. A quick comment, though. Literature, you got to remember the day that we're talking about. There wasn't any TV. There's not any mass communication. These people read books. They shared books with each other. They talked about what book are you reading. This was the major communication of its day. And so these literature, the books, the pamphlets, things were passing around. Dr. Bob passed those out like candy, kept them on hand. I still today in my home group, you can't come in there and hang around very long before you're going to get a copy of The Greatest Thing in the World. This is real basic stuff. Move on a little bit. You want to go to Henry B. Wright? Drummond really influenced...
You talk about
it. Henry B., well, I keep thinking in the back of my mind, we got to get to Alcoholics Anonymous someday, but then other folks are saying, no, this early background... Drummond influenced another preacher, Henry B. Wright. And Wright took these ideas, refined them a little bit further. Wright was the mentor of another guy. He passed it down. This is the whole chain of command here. A fellow by the name of Frank Bookman got these ideas from Wright, who got them from Drummond, who got them from Moody. That's the direct that I can find the line so far. Let's go on and get into Bookman.
Bookman, okay. Now, there was another book that was important, and that was The Principles of Jesus, where they got the Four Absolutes. And in AA, there's still quite a controversy about the Four Absolutes. Everybody knows about the Four Absolutes. And this was really the main program of the Oxford Group, these Four Absolutes of selfishness, purity, honesty, and love. Yep. Yes. And they came from a book, a 1902 book, which I think you have here. It was called The Principles of Jesus, and the author
Principles of Jesus.
Robert E. Speer was a student. He was a follower of Dwight L. Moody, and he was a student of Henry B. Wright, who was a professor of religion at Yale. And in those days, you could go to Yale and actually find out something about religion. Nowadays it would be attacked, that sort of thing. But in those days, but wouldn't it? I mean, I remember a book called God and Man at Yale.
Are we going to need the opinion sign back here?
Yeah, that's.
when we went out for coffee last night, we had Peter suggested. He said that's a pretty good sign and everything, but you may want to have another one up there. It says LIAR. Go just a little too far, you might
want to
use that one.
But anyway, Frank Bookman was born in 1878 near Allentown, Pennsylvania. And he grew up in a Lutheran family, and he became a Lutheran minister. And this was a Pennsylvania Dutch group of people. And even though his family operated a saloon for a while, he never drank himself. Never had any strong opinions about drinking or anything like that, but he was to found a movement that would turn out to have some success in helping alcoholics. Well, he attended theological seminary and became a devoted Lutheran minister, and he started running a little hospice for orphan boys in Philadelphia. And he was the sort of guy that really liked to help people, I believe. There's no question about that. He was a humanitarian person. And he had some other traits also that later on became evident, but he really had this strong desire to help these orphan boys. But he got in a fight with his trustees over the budget, over the food budget or something, and he resigned his post in 1907, really probably almost got fired. He was only 30 years old, and so his parents had given him a little money, and he took a long trip. He was very bitter towards these trustees. Just had one hell of a resentment. I guess he wanted to see these guys dead almost.
Oh, that's bad.
And, of course, this just went with him on his travels, and he wound up in Keswick, Scotland. And that's a place where they have religious meetings every summer. They were having them, and he went there to hear a famous minister. Now, this was, by this time, it was 1908. And he was in this little town of Keswick, and he was wandering around, and this is his personal testimony. He wandered into this little church, and there was a woman speaking before about 17 people. And he listened to her talk, and he just had a tremendous spiritual change as a result of this. And this is what he talked about all his life. He lived for another 53 years, but he had this tremendous change.
I actually had a vision.
Saw
the crucified cross.
This was right. He just had a complete, everything just changed. It was right there. It was instantaneous. And this woman, at first we thought she was a Salvation Army woman. Willard Hunter used to tell me that. But we tracked it down from a talk Frank Buchman made. And her name was Jessie Penn Lewis. And she had been influenced in the tradition of Moody and Finney and all these people. And here are some of her books. The Awakening in Wales, The Cross of Calvary. And if I were to go to any AA meeting and pick out a page of this book and start reading it, I'd be out on my ass in 2 minutes. You know? Yeah. I mean, take that off the tape.
That would take you that long?
No, it's okay. You wipe that up.
It'd take two minutes in Toledo, take that long?
Yeah, just about, you know. But this is really religious, very strongly religious stuff. But nevertheless, whatever it was, it reached this guy and it changed him. And he went back to his rooming house and he wrote letters making amends to all of these trustees, these seven or eight trustees, you know. Now, see, here's the AA program starting right there. And it just so changed his life. He came back home and then he became went to Penn State as a kind of a youth advisor, and he had a lot of luck there of helping students, the young students, with their problems. And there was one notable example, the campus bootlegger. The guy's name was actually Gil Lilland, but they always called him Bill Pickle for obvious reasons. And Bill Pickle had his life changed as a result. At first he was Bootman's critic and enemy and everything, and then he had his life changed, this alcoholic. And then other alcoholics came along and were helped over the years by Buchman. And I think there was another influence here, and it was a 1909 book called Twice Born Men. You've got that, I hope.
Yeah.
And this book was written by a fellow named Harold Begbie. Begbie later was a biographer of General William Booth of the Salvation Army. But this book is about a group of alcoholics in a small part of London who became converted to the Salvation Army and quit drinking and changed their lives, Twice Born Men. Now, I think, here we're in opinion very much, because we don't have any real proof, but I think this book influenced the Buchman and the Oxford group in their work with alcoholics. This book was proof that people who have a religious or spiritual experience can change their lives and overcome a hideous problem like alcoholism.
Here's some other, to give you an idea of where Begbie was coming. Here's a couple other titles. See, the books all match. Souls in Action, The Crucible of the New Life by Begbie. The Ordinary Man and the Extraordinary Thing by Begbie. We're talking about digging into somebody and changing your entire life as the answer.
Yeah. Well, now that book, Twice Born Men, was dedicated to William James, who had written Varieties of Religious Experience. See, so we just find these people crossing each other's paths all the time. And then in 1925, pardon?
There's a footnote in Narrative to Professor William James. By Harold Baker.
Yeah, The Varieties of Religious Experience was one of these landmark books. I mean, you just keep reading references to it all the time. It was an important work. People often talk about science and religion and the attempts to make them more compatible. But guys like William James tried to do that. with a book like The Varieties of Religious Experience. They tried to make these ideas intellectually acceptable.
You know, a little bit later on, Begbie is, he was so impressed with this life-changing process and everything here. A little bit later on, this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous is going to get started. He's going to write another book called More, Twice Born Men.
That's about the Oxford book.
And he's going to follow the beginnings of this AA. It's in the Oxford group. It's going to tie in the personal evangelism of Moody. It's going to tie in the intellectual, scholarly overview that Wright gave it. And it's going to bring, and then he gets Bookman's personality, the overwhelming, man, he can really go out there and get you kind of a thing. And AA today is our 12th step. You go out there and you get so much out of personally working with, and the one-on-one business is what makes AA work.
Well, Bookman worked at Penn State through the teens, and then later on he went to Hartford Seminary and worked there in Hartford, Connecticut. And he just seemed to have a great talent for working with young people, but he also, right in the very beginning almost, there's controversy followed him. Now, he met Sam Shoemaker in China in 1918, and this was an important thing for AA. Sam Shoemaker at that time was a young Princeton graduate expecting to go into the Episcopal ministry, and he was over in Beijing today, but it was called Peking then. And he was over there running some classes for young Chinese boys. He also wanted to start a Bible class. So he starts this Bible class, and right away the attendance falls off. Well, Bookman was in China, in Peking, doing some things. So Shoemaker went over to see him, to see if Bookman could come and talk at his class and maybe get it going again. And instead, Bookman listened to Shoemaker, and he says, why don't you reach just one of those people yourself? And in other words, Shoemaker had some problems of his own that he wasn't facing and everything. And this is what, Bookman had this kind of talent. He could make people face themselves, you know. I'm sure if Bookman were alive today, he would come here and find out that we all were lacking. I wouldn't want to sit down with him.
But, a softer, easier fourth step.
Yes, I'm always looking for the softer, easier way. But he had that talent, and he could apparently confront people in some way that really made them accept it too. And so Shoemaker went back to his room and went home, and he was very bitter about. He had a resentment towards Bookman, but then he faced his own faults and whatever it was, and went back and told Bookman that he was right. That Bookman was right. And that started their friendship. And that was really important for AA, you see, because it changed Shoemaker's life. He, in a few years, he was the pastor of Calvary Church in New York, and he was the guy that would be the main Oxford group person when Bill Wilson and came in. And he also, Shoemaker also had an influence on the Akron end of things, which we'll get to later. But this was Bookman, and it's just amazing to find the influence of Bookman, the way it reaches out, and a lot of people don't even suspect it. For example, one of the great writers in religion was a fellow named Leslie Weatherhead. He wrote a lot of books. He was an influence on Peter Marshall, that Catherine Marshall wrote about Peter Marshall. Well, Marshall followed Weatherhead's writings and everything in his sermons. And Weatherhead credited the Oxford group with his own change in life, you see. And here was a man that wrote a lot of things that influenced people who might have even been critical of the Oxford group. So it's very safe to say that Bookman was probably one of the most important people of the 20th century, no question about it.
Nominated for the Nobel Prize.
Oh, yeah, several times, this kind of thing. Of course, just to be nominated, that's like running for president, isn't it? You know, anybody can run. Now, I'm putting him down. I shouldn't be doing that.